Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz, episode 28, WebDAV. This show and the entire TWiT broadcast network is brought to you by donations from listeners like you. Thanks. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show where we cover open source, free, Libre software. I did that backwards. That would be awful, awful. It's free job. Libre and open source software. Floss.
I'm going to have to fire you as a new and hire a new opening guy.
Ausful. Welcome to Ausful Weekly. See, it just doesn't have that same ring, doesn't it?
No, I'm glad the letters are in the proper order now. That's right.
How are you, Randall? We've had, this is like the third show in a row. We actually are putting these, slowing them down a little bit from the speedy recording we're doing, just because I'm going to be in Australia and we want to make sure we had some great content while I was gone. But I really appreciate the work you've been doing. I guess you're not, you haven't been cruising lately.
I have not been cruising lately. We're in a little bit of a lull. Speaking of cruises, we've been putting some wonderful content from the Scientific American Cruise on my other podcast, which is at podcast.geekcruises.com. That's podcast.geekcruises.com. We just finished up a six-part series, or just in the middle, actually, of a six-part series on how language affects the way you think. Very cool stuff.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, it's incredible. We had a wonderful lady, Dr. Alice Gaby. She's from Melbourne, Australia. So she speaks with this wonderful, cute Australian accent. Not enough to where you can't actually understand it. But it's a great series. And actually, I've got to say that by mentioning that show on this show, I've gotten an incredible bump in listenership. So thank you, Leo, for letting me listen occasionally on this show.
Go listen. Please
do.
Especially that Scientific American series. You're going to want to hear it. It's just very interesting stuff.
Got another 10 hours after that. So please listen. And there's plenty of stuff there, and I'll just be dribbling it all through the summer. Yeah.
Captain Neil, it really teased me. He sent a note about a month ago saying, we're planning a great, I think it was 2009 cruise. Can you go on it? And I said, you know what? It's been so long since I've been on. I would really like to go on one, so I'll go. And I think by 2009, I can do it. And cool. then he didn't say anything else, so I don't even know if it's still on or what. But
I'm sure it is. He's been really busy setting up the stuff for a lot of other 2009 cruises right now. But I can't exactly give you the exact numbers, but Scientific American wants a lot of cruises.
Oh, that's keeping him busy.
And so we're setting all those up, and about a year out, there's always a lot of work to do. So I'm sure he's just spinning trying to make that all happen.
Oh yeah. Well, he said it would be finalized in the next few months. So as soon as I know. I'll start plugging it. So, and of course, one good thing about this is we know Randall will be on it.
Yeah. And before we get to today's guest, by the way, I do want to say that I'm really excited. I just got elected to the Squeak Foundation board.
Hey, congratulations.
That on top of all the other stuff, you know, the talking about small talk the last few months and a few of the podcasts here, I'm now part of the group of nine people, one of which is Dan Ingalls, one of the co-inventors of small talk.
Wow.
And I'm in incredible good company on this thing. And so I get to help decide the direction of Squeak over the next year. My bent, of course, is to really make sure it stays open source, but also stays commercially viable so that I can use it for my clients and use it for projects like Seaside, like what we talked with Abby Bryant with. And so I'm really thrilled. It was a shock. It was totally out of left field for me. And I did very little campaigning. I just simply threw my name into the ring and people like me, I guess.
Well, I think that's very appropriate. And I want to thank you too. In fact, our guest today, Greg Stein, has served on a couple of open source foundations. And I think that's really, as much work as the programmers do to keep these programs going, it's the people who run the foundations who make it happen. It's a really important job. Some very tricky issues that are always being addressed. And I'm just very grateful to people who serve on these foundations, keeping this stuff going. Mm-hmm. So thank you for doing that. I'm thrilled. When do you start?
I started, actually, I had my first conference call today, my first chat today, so I'm actually in gear already. Yeah.
That's exciting. Squeak, for those who don't know, is squeak.org, and that is the current really open source version of Smalltalk, originally developed by Alan Kay, first at Apple and then at Disney. And that's where it got the Squeak name and the little mouse logo.
Exactly.
It is, we've talked about it before, it is available for free. It is part of the eToys portion of the OLPC. It's just some really neat stuff.
And we're going to get Alan Kay or Dan Ingles on very soon on this podcast.
That would be great.
I'll go Jason going on.
Don't say or, say and.
Okay. Sure, I'll put them both on.
No ors. Yeah. We would like to do two shows, one with Alan and one with Danny.
Very good. They both have perspectives, yeah.
Our guest today, Greg Stein, is, I mentioned, he's very active in the open source community. He's the chairman of the Apache board at one time. He's also been on the Python Foundation.
And fellow Portlander. Don't forget the Portland part.
And born in Portland.
Portland, Oregon. In fact, actually, the way he got on today's show is that I ended up seeing him when he came to visit some people up in Portland, Oregon, back in December. And he invited all of his friends out, and we have mutual friends. So they invited me to go hang out at this pub that he showed up at. And so I'm sitting across the table from him, and I said, you know, you're a big open source guy, and I just happen to have this little podcast that I'm doing. Would you consider it? He says, sure, sure. So we exchanged credentials, and that's how he's on today's show.
Well, great, because he's been everywhere. He's done everything. His current project is, besides Google Code, is web dev. Let's say hi to Gregory Jacob Stein. So I don't know how we should introduce you. Director of the Apache Software Foundation, former chairman, member of the Python Software Foundation, maintainer of Python and its libraries from 1999 to 2002. You work at Google now, and I guess most importantly, web dev.
Yes, lots of web dev stuff.
What is web dev?
Web dev is stands for web-based distributed authoring and versioning. And actually, the very first version of the spec didn't even have any versioning in it.
But you just put it in the name just in case.
Yeah, exactly. Basically, you'd call it web da.
But da.
When I was at Microsoft, they were starting to switch over to web dev for like all their protocol stuff rather than doing NNTP plus POP plus IMAP plus FTP plus this, that, and the other thing. They're like, let's just do all web dev. And so I was like, you know, that actually makes sense. And right as I was, and that was happening right as I was leaving Microsoft. And so after I left, I was like, you know, I don't want to see the open source world get cut out of this kind of, you know, unified protocol thing where this, you know, protocol can be so handy. And so I started working on a module for Apache to implement web dev.
So from my point of view as a really dumb user, web dev just makes it, it kind of is like taking an FTP site or a site where files are and making it mount on my system like it's a drive. It's kind of it makes stuff visible like a drive. Is that
right?
Is that the point?
Yeah,
of it?
Yeah. I guess I didn't. Yeah, I really didn't answer the first question very well, did I?
No,
yeah,
you did for the geek. But I just kind of, and most of the people who listen, let's face it, if you listen to Floss Weekly, you're a geek. But just so people understand who maybe haven't run into web dev.
Yeah, but basically it turns the web into where, you know, historically it was just a read-only web. You'd go, you get web pages. Web dev allows it to be read-write. And then with cool clients like, you know, what you can find in more recent versions of Mac OS X, in newer versions of Windows, yeah, you can mount a web dev server and it appears just like, you know, any other, you know, mounted file system. And in fact, Apple has pretty well deprecated their AppleTalk protocol, the Apple file sharing or whatever it is, in favor of just sticking to web dev.
Yeah, I mean, I see when I mount my iDisk then on my Mac, that's a web dev server running there.
Yeah. Yeah, the other neat thing is what Microsoft did, this is actually a pretty early version of Microsoft Office, is in the file open box, you could type in a URL to a web dev enabled server. And it would open up, you know, say a Word document right off of the server. You could edit the thing and save it right back to the server. And it was really cool. And so it made, you know, sort of editing web pages and things a lot easier for people that, you know, don't understand FTP or something. They're just like, hey, I want to edit that document right there. And you type in the URL. And edit the thing. So
it really hides a lot of the now getting back to your original statement, it's a way of hiding complex protocols so that it all looks just like a file system.
Yeah. There's a basic file system, and then each of the files and directories in there also have arbitrary properties that you can attach. And so that's all of your various metadata.
Properties and, how? Like permissions or?
It can be permissions. It can also be things like, you know, who authored the document, maybe a summary or abstract attached onto the document that, you know, as you're just browsing through a directory of these things, you can take a look at these properties and see those before you actually, you know, download the document. The properties are used extensively for a lot of the more advanced web dev protocols like versioning and access control and quota management and things like that.
You were
so for example, in something like Subversion, where Subversion wants to store not only the file contents, but also some meta information, perhaps about the nature of the commit and things like that, right?
Yeah, in Subversion, there's a resource that corresponds to the whole commit. And yeah, we attach... when you're using the web dev protocol to do the commit, we attach properties to the revision as a whole. But Subversion also allows arbitrary properties to be attached to files. And yeah, we use web dev properties for that. A good example is the MIME type for a file. So if you have, you know, some .html file, you can assign a MIME type to it that says text/HTML. And then when you go and hit it with your browser, it comes back with the right MIME type and gets displayed properly. And so this is why people can actually use Subversion and create their websites that are directly hosted straight out of Subversion.
Wow. I've noticed that. So I can go directly to a Subversion repository. So you're saying that that's actually hitting the WebDAV URL from the browser, and I can see things that way. But you're also saying that I would hit that same URL from Subversion and be able to write into that directory if I was given the right permissions then, correct?
That's correct.
Or if the MIME type were HTML, it would show up in your browser as a web page.
Yeah.
Yes.
Nice.
Or you know, tagging images as JPEGs or GIFs or things like that. So when your browser hits it, it gets back the right MIME type.
It's interesting because of your heritage with Apache, and of course you were one of the founders of the Subversion project. It's interesting, kind of this is an intersection between the two in some ways.
Right. In early 2000, I think it was probably February 2000, and Carl Fogel had been hired by CollabNet to build Subversion. And Brian Bellendorf, who was, you know, one of my colleagues at Apache, he knew about my web dev work. And he's like, Greg, do you want to do web dev for Subversion? I'm like, I was totally gung-ho to do that. And so I talked to Carl. And he's like, well, I'm still trying to figure things out. Come back to me in March. And so I came back and I'm like, I'm ready to go. I'm ready to go. And he kind of hemmed and hawed. And there was this big group meeting in April 2000. And everybody in the room was like, no, that's not going to be very efficient. We need to have a custom protocol and this and that. And I was like, all right, I think it'll work. And, you know, I gave a bunch of reasons. And, you know, you can reuse Apache, you can reuse SSL, you can reuse authentication stuff, all these things. And then I said, look, guys, when are you going to do the networking code? And they said, well, maybe in the fall or something like that. I said, let me just go ahead and write it, and you can see, you know, whether it works for you. And then in July, Ben Colin Sussman, he went onto his Windows laptop and mounted a Subversion repository and started browsing through
cool.
it. And he's just like, okay, done. I'm sold.
Wow. High coolness so factor.
It was pretty difficult to get some of the performance you know, in there with web dev, because latency around you know, making a request to the server and getting a response, and what you really need is HTTP pipelining, but the library we had didn't do that. And so another project I had started with a friend was a new HTTP client library that could do pipelining and high performance IO and all this stuff. And that's an option in Subversion 1.5 now. You can build with that thing. But we had to make a bunch of changes in the basic web dev support for Subversion to get that to, you know, really work well. And as it ends up, somebody did come along later and created a custom Subversion protocol. And mostly that was used to be able to tunnel it through SSH, which is when you look at how a lot of CVS repositories were done, is people would alter the CVS repository by tunneling through SSH and then performing CVS operations on the target server. And so all the people that had CVS set up that way and wanted to switch to Subversion, they didn't want to have to redo all their security infrastructure. You know, they had SSH set up. Everybody was all set. They had all the key pairs out there done. And so this was a great way for people to easily switch over to Subversion without worrying about whole new security. You know, switching to SSL and Apache and its authentication stuff, blah, blah, blah.
So this is the CVS P server kind of thing, right? I SSH into a server and I run a small application on the other end that provides the other half of the protocol.
Exactly, exactly.
And we do the same thing with Subversion now. Now, is that a lot faster than using DAV, or is it in the same ballpark, or?
I think it's a little faster in general. I do think it's faster in general because it is more tuned. But in your general like updates and commits and things like that, it's actually not too bad.
And that also says a lot about how fast DAV protocol is then as well, right? You probably spent a lot of time making DAV protocol on the Apache end of it work really fast, right?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, sort of batching things together. And so really you're constrained by your network. And so when you're talking about transferring data, you know, like when you do an initial checkout, the entire time is bounded by the network latency to ship all that content over there. And there really isn't going to be any difference between web dev and a custom protocol. It's when you're starting.
Unless you're sitting at Google with really fast pipes there, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, there's certainly in certain operations, the SVN protocol, you know, can show itself to be faster, but most people don't really notice it. And the web dev protocol has a lot of extra advantages. And this is, you know, one of the primary things is that by moving away from SSH, you no longer have to maintain accounts on the server. And so this is why the Apache Software Foundation switched over from CVS to Subversion, is that our Subversion server, only some of our administrators can log on. No longer can arbitrary users log on to that machine, which means that the repository is much, much safer. You know, people can't get on there and exploit, you know, some local exploit and take over the machine like we had once happen a long time ago. Somebody came in from a compromised SourceForge machine. They got into Apache, did a local exploit, and then, you know, the whole foundation spent like a month or 6 weeks carefully reviewing every single file to see if anybody had modified any of the code in the CVS repository. And that just can't happen today anymore. Or, well, it's harder, I should say.
So the DAV protocol you mentioned already, it runs on obviously Linux and also Windows and OS X. Is it pretty portable across all three architectures?
Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, from a client standpoint, there's a lot of clients out there. When was it? Was I guess in like 99, Adobe had like this set of 10 technology initiatives, and one of those was WebDAV. And so I went and spoke to the Adobe engineering division about WebDAV, and they started adding that to all of their products. So pretty much all Adobe products are WebDAV capable.
Wow.
And you see a lot of different clients now that deal with WebDAV. Servers, there's not as many servers. You know, when I did the module for Apache, that was pretty much like, okay, well, you know, we have it now. Why do we have to go build another one? You know, Apache is just kind of a workhorse. And then ModDev, people actually started looking at ModDev as sort of a reference implementation for the IETF RFC.
So did ModDev get you involved with Apache then? Is that your entry point, or were you there already before?
That was my entry point. September 98 is when I started looking at Apache. And a guy named Ben Laurie, he had looked at WebDAV a little bit and was thinking about it. And when I posted to the list that I was going to start doing this, he was like, oh, that's great. You know, I was kind of interested but hadn't started yet. And so I started working with the server and getting some patches in there. And then, you know, working more and more with the Apache HTTP server itself. And then that was pretty much sort of how I arrived at Apache.
And so what was your responsibilities? You were like the chairman of the Apache Software Foundation for a while?
Yeah. So they started the foundation in June 99. And then I became a they started with a certain set of members, and then at the first members meeting where they voted in new members, I became a member right after that. And then in spring 2001, I think it was, I was elected to the board. And so, you know, I became a director at that point. And then in August 2002, Roy Fielding, he had been the chairman for 3 years since the inception of the foundation. And he was like, you know, I've got so much stuff going on. I'm a little bit burned out on this. I'd like to step down as chairman. And you know, this was during the board meeting. And on we always do it via conference call. And in fact, I just had our conference call like 4 hours ago. Our board meeting is third Wednesday of every month. Anyway, mm-hmm. He's like, and I'd like to nominate Greg as the chairman.
Congratulations. Wow. You're the winner.
Yeah, and I was like, I mean, this came from total left field. He hadn't talked to me about it before. I hadn't even thought, I mean, none of us were, thought he was going to go anywhere. He'd been, you know, sort of the driving force behind the foundation. All of a sudden he's like, I think Greg would make a great chairman. I kind of blinked for a bit and sat there and I was like, well, sure, why not? Well, because at this point, when I had left Microsoft in August 98, I wasn't working at the time. And so I had, you know, 3 years where I was just kind of goofing around. And in 2002, when he said this, I was working at CollabNet and I was, you know, very heavily involved in Subversion and Apache and APR and all this. And CollabNet was giving me a lot of time to do this. And so he was like, you know, I think this makes great sense. And so I was like, all right, let's try it. And then, so I was chairman for 5 years. And so in our last, we elect the board. Generally, we have a members meeting in like May every year, and then elect the board, and then the next board meeting we appoint new officers. And so this was last June, and I've been chairman for almost 5 years. I was like, you know, I'm done. I don't want to go for chairman again. I was feeling pretty burned out. I'd already gone 2 years longer than the founder of the foundation. It was just so Jim Jagielski was nominated, and everyone was just like, yep, that's a great choice. And so nobody.
Did you ambush him the same way you had been ambushed before?
No, somebody else ambushed him.
Oh. It's the way.
It is the way.
Surprise, so, surprise, surprise.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Jim had been the secretary for the 7 years, 8 years that the foundation had been in existence. So he kind of, you know, dropped that off and switched into the chairman role. So, I mean, Jim has been, you know, dedicated to the foundation ever since the beginning. He certainly has a lot more staying power than I ever did.
So what does the Apache Software Foundation actually do? What are the biggest concerns you had, say, in the last 5 years?
A lot of it is, you know, really just trying to provide really good and useful software to people. I mean, you know, the charter of the foundation is build software and make it available to the public at no charge, or, you know, something like that. I forget what the right wording is, but that's the basic philosophy. And during that time, I did a lot of talking about our philosophy and our philosophy around licensing and how we don't want to try and control other people's use with our license, that we want to make it broadly available, that, you know, that community is more important than the code bases itself, that we want to do sort of, you know, long-term community management rather than code base management. I mean, one of the things that I would do every now and then, kind of throwing out to people, is say, okay, you know, here's where we are today. We've got, you know, 25 different projects under the Apache umbrella. How are we going to make sure that all of those projects are still here in 10 years? How are we going to make sure they're still here in 25 years? And wow. when you start thinking that way, it kind of changes your perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of it was, you know, just kind of how we structure things. And, you know, we kind of worry about this at the board level, like, what's that umbrella that we make sure that everybody can get their work done and remain safe? You know, we don't want somebody getting sued for some code that they write. We want to be able to say, hey, they didn't write the code on their own. The Apache Software Foundation directed them to do it. So therefore, it's our responsibility, not them. And so, you know, our theory is that in any problematic lawsuits, we can always jump in there. But, you know, and it's worrying about trademarks and the brand name and stuff like that.
Is that similar to what you were doing for the Python Software Foundation as well?
I was involved with getting the Python Software Foundation started, but was never really involved all that much with it. When we were just starting that up, myself and Dick Hart, we went and grabbed the Apache Software Foundation bylaws, and then we added a different class of members. And we call them nominated members and sponsor members. And sponsor members actually pay to get a vote in the Python Software Foundation. Dick was at Active State at the time, and he wanted to be able, you know, to have some participation in the foundation. So we kind of rejiggered the bylaws a little bit and then floated those out. Everyone was good with it, and that's when the foundation started. But today, I haven't really been involved with the Python community for quite a few years now. Apache has really kind of taken a lot of my focus.
Well, you are working with Google. In fact, it's interesting. So you said you worked at CollabNet for a while?
Yeah. Yeah, I was at CollabNet for 2.5 years.
Were you part of SourceForge at all? Or
no. No, I left almost 4 years ago.
So before SourceForge. Okay.
Was like maybe a year ago or something when they acquired that.
Right. But you are doing something similar for Google.
Yes. Yes. That was a decision that we made. Ooh, it's been almost 3 years ago. It was in the summer of 2005. We were looking at different ways. Myself and Chris DeBona, the two of us represent the Open Source Program Office. And
this is what cracks me up, by the way. Chris DeBona did this show for about a year. We never interviewed you once. took Randall to get you on the show. Okay, I'm not going to say anything. You're sitting next to Chris DeBona. Okay, I'm not going to say anything.
Would you
pinch him for me, all right?
he stepped out. But okay. I told him you guys were wanting me to give him hell for the whole thing. So, 2005, it was just the two of us. And we were like, our job is to support the open source community. That's everything that we're supposed to do. And so one of the things that we looked at is SourceForge, and SourceForge is just like a cornerstone of the open source community.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And one of the things that we asked ourselves is, what happens if we get up at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning and SourceForge is dark? What the heck would happen to the open source community? And, that's kind of a freaky proposition. And so, we talked to the SourceForge guys about, different ways that we could help out and this and that. And we were never able to find a really good match. And so Chris and I, we kind of sat down and brainstormed for an afternoon and said, well, let's just build it ourselves. And so we got permission to start hiring people onto the team to build it. And that was around July or August of 2005. And then we launched it July 2006.
It's a great resource for the open source community. Google Code is a really well done. Did you feel there needed to be an additional? I mean, since there is SourceForge, how do you separate the two?
So what we really want to do is not. Yeah, I mean, our intent was never to destroy SourceForge, but to provide an alternative. I mean, we have a lot of different technology here. Our free text search engine, our scalable storage systems, our infrastructure, a lot of these different things that we could throw into the mix that would provide sort of a new way to approach how to do open source hosting.
Right.
One of the other things is after our own experience using these tools, after our experience at CollabNet, Chris's experience with SourceForge, we also knew what open source programmers wanted.
Right.
When you look at CollabNet's offering, it's geared for the enterprise, and the enterprise has got a lot more needs around user and role management and permissions and all of this.
Yeah.
And open source programmers, they're just like, can you commit or not?
Right.
That's about
it. That's all we care about, right?
Yeah. So we wound it all back and we tried to provide a fresh, clean view from scratch on what sort of today's open source programmer needs from a tool set. And so we got our Subversion hosting going. We created a new issue tracker. and then basic project pages and administration. And we launched that. Now, we knew, the hugest efficiency was no download system. You know, where do you put your tarballs? Where do you put your RPMs? And we didn't have that. We said, we recognize this, but we think the Subversion repository and the issue tracker is going to be useful. And we can start getting feedback from you on the issue tracker. And given the uptake and the activity during those 6 months until we released the download system, I think our call was right, and we started getting feedback on the issue tracker. And generally, people liked the free form nature of it and point to it as one of the nice innovations that we took from project hosting. So we released the downloads and wiki, and that kind of rounded out the offering. And then just a couple weeks ago, it was launched a while ago, but we didn't really sort of advertise it a whole bunch, but our repository browser and added that. And that was really kind of like the last major feature that people have been asking for is that repository browser.
How many projects are on the Google Code now?
We're getting up near 90,000 projects.
Wow.
That's really amazing. I mean, you've been around for about a year.
Year and a half. Yeah.
So that's quite a lot.
What's the development cycle like on that? How many programmers do you have working on your side on that piece?
The development team for code.google, for the project hosting, I think there's probably 6 to 8, something like that. Mm. So it's actually not a very large team, but This is one of the neat things is, like I said, here at Google, our storage system, that's managed by another team that's got, 40 people going, and they've got several project managers and product managers. There's just, it's huge. Every big table, there's the big table white paper. And so, we base everything on big table and it gives us highly scalable, fully redundant storage systems. We don't have to go and bother with that. We don't have to define a backup solution. Because somebody else already did it.
Right.
And so our even though we have a small team, we've got so much leverage based on everything that the Google engineering workforce has been able to do.
Wow. You use the you actually offer a variety of licenses, but you encourage the Apache license on here.
So on Google Code for the project hosting, one of the things that we did before we launched it is I talked to Chris and I was like, this would be a really nice approach to be able to deal with the license proliferation problem. What do you think if we offered a subset of licenses? Mm-hmm. He kind of thought about it for a second. He's like, sure. And so we spent maybe 15 minutes and just kind of ticked off, all the main licenses. And that's what we started off with. And it was 6 licenses. And then like 4 weeks before we were about to launch, one of the guys, he's a big Perl programmer. He's like, dude, where's the artistic license? And we're like, okay.
Go.
I mean, we don't want to piss off the Perl community.
No.
So,
So what are the licenses you have?
So we started with the artistic license, the Apache version 2 license, GPL v2, LGPL, MPL 1.1, BSD, and MIT.
Seems like that would be enough.
And then we added GPL v3 once that was ratified. Yeah. So we're at 8 licenses. But as soon as like somebody on the team gets it in their shorts enough, we're going to go and pull out MPL. There are so few projects that use it that we prefer to just take it out of the running and just continue working against proliferation of licenses.
You said, I actually, looking on your Wikipedia article, I found an interesting story about you from 2006 in InfoWorld. You were speaking at the EclipseCon and said commercial software is dead.
Yeah.
You still, that 2 years ago, you still feel like we're on track?
Yes. Yeah.
Why?
I mean, when you take a look at a software stack and the things that people are building, it just keeps growing and growing and growing. It used to be oh, there's no way somebody can develop an operating system. It was done. There's no way somebody can do an office suite.
Right.
It was done.
Right.
There's no way somebody can do an ERP system. It's mostly in progress. There's no way, no way somebody can compete against Oracle and their RDMS. It's been done.
Right.
And you just look at pretty much every single type of software out there, software category, and they're just slowly getting knocked down.
Sure. We're going to do Sugar CRM next week. I mean, who would have thought a CRM would be open source?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's almost like the definitive commercial program.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Exactly. You know, I mean, it, what I do think you'll see a lot of services that are not open source. I mean, you know, Google provides services out the wazoo, and our code is generally not open source. Salesforce.com, again, a great service company, but they don't provide their source code. But other people are doing some of these things and releasing it. So you'll see, like, you know, smaller installations or, you know, things that maybe integrate well with particular subsystems or, you know, other back-end things that an enterprise might be running and they need some custom integration.
Yeah, I was going to say probably some vertical markets are going to have some closed source stuff. But the infrastructure stuff, as you say, probably will all be open source eventually.
Exactly. Now, I do think that there's a couple types of software that will never really be open source. And the biggest one is applications that are very rich in content. Games are a canonical example. Or all the sets of rules in a tax preparation software. You know, going out and scanning all the different tax laws across the United States and all the jurisdictions and assembling all those into one package. And where there's a huge investment in content, it just doesn't, the open source methodology has not been able to replicate that very well at all. And so I think those kinds of very content-rich applications will always be able to remain closed source. They may use toolkits which are open source, particularly in gaming environments, but I don't think that the packages that you go and buy will ever truly be open source.
It's probably because in that point you're getting, help me if I'm wrong here, but one of the advantages of open source is you have a lot of eyes looking at it and therefore can contribute to it. And when you have something as specialized as what you just talked about, there aren't a lot of eyes that can really look at it and help. And so you're not getting the benefit of scale there, right?
Yeah, you know, you take a game with the level designers and animators and, you know, the storylines and, you know, there's a whole ton of different kinds of things that go into it and ways to manage that. And the kind of chaotic nature around open source development is not very well tuned to that kind of tightly controlled content development.
Okay, interesting.
Well, I'm just looking at your career. It's amazing all the places you've been. You've had a hand in so many important projects. One of the things our listeners want us to ask everybody is what your current development platform is. But you know, obviously Python was big on your plate for a long time. C must have been. What do you work with these days?
Python.
You're still a Python guy.
Totally. I've been using Python now for 13 years and expect to continue using it. I'll use C or C++ when sort of circumstances dictate. Like when we started off the Subversion project, one of the questions that came up with is what language are we going to implement this thing in? And we chose plain C because we foresaw that there was a larger body of C developers than anybody else. We also wanted to be able to create bindings from Python and Perl and all these other languages into the C libraries to enable, you know, scripting tools and things like that. And so for that project, it was C. And we avoided C++ because in 2000, remarkably, C++ was still not all that standardized. It was actually kind of difficult to ensure that whatever you built was going to be compilable on all these different platforms and operating systems and tool chains. And so we just went with vanilla C. But now whenever I've got a new project, I'll tackle it with Python unless there's something that says, no, you really need to use C. Like, you know, if I'm extending some existing C, or one of the, some of the development that I've been doing here at Google over the past 6 months is in Java, actually. So that's like my, you know, 15th choice of language. But, you know, circumstances dictate I do Java. So,
and when you use Python, are you, do you have any frameworks you use? What's your environment? You use idle? How do you develop? You're probably just like a command line guy.
Emacs,
of course.
Yay. Emacs in the shell window. I've been using Emacs, and this is where I'm going to show my age here. I've been using Emacs for 22 and a half years.
Cool.
So I discovered Emacs in fall of 85, and that's just been my editor of choice ever since.
You have a lot of custom key bindings, or you?
Nope.
Really?
One of the things, this was, oh man, probably like 6 years ago or something. And when I'm installing a new Linux box, and I'd get everything installed, and then I'd spend a day doing my individual little tweaks and customizations and getting everything just so. And what happens is every time you do that, you do a few less customizations. You don't quite get to something you just go, whatever. Yeah. You know, I just don't care enough. And so once when I was trying to get FVWM onto a Red Hat X desktop, because that was the one I'd been using, and it was just a pain in the butt. And so I was like, okay, whatever Red Hat is giving me by default, I'll just deal with it. And I've got a little .emacs file that's maybe a couple hundred lines, and that's it. Because if I go to somebody else's box and I pull up Emacs, and if I'm completely bound to all this customization, I won't be functional.
Right.
And so I get rid of it and stick to plain old defaults as much as I can across the entire operating system.
I think this is what happens when you get older.
You get simpler. Life gets boiled down.
Yeah. You know, it's just, how can I be best productive? Yeah. And you run with it. And yeah.
Defaults look good. So how about frameworks? Do you use any frameworks at all? Or?
No, not so much. A lot of the Python programming that I've been doing here, I get to use some internal Google stuff that are actually bindings against our C++ code base. You know, so like Google Code is pretty much all Python. And then it binds against some low-level libraries in C++ that deal with HTTP serving and RPCs and talking to Bigtable and all that kind of stuff. And that's just Python bindings to those libraries. And then we do everything in a high-level language.
Right.
Your web serving is done with a custom server then, right?
Yes. Yeah. There's no way. We do have some Apache here because that's the easiest way to bring up Subversion. But it's a pain in the ass. It really doesn't mesh well with our standard operational environment. Google's got internal HP serving technology that works really well in this environment. And so that's what we use for the main Google Code site. But for the Subversion handling, that actually ends up, we've got some stuff in front of it, but it ends up eventually talking to an Apache server.
Wow, cool. Now, was VueCVS done in Python?
Say that again. What
was VueCVS done in Python? Or
yeah, VVC? Yeah. It's called VueVC now. I started VueCVS way back in like 99 or something like that. I was working on ModDav at the time, and it was stored in a CVS library, a CVS repository, and I had CVS web plugged in there so I could browse it on the web, and you know, everything was all good. And then there was something really annoying about CVS web. I don't know what the heck it was, but I was in there trying to make some changes and some pretty straightforward stuff. And I can get my way around Perl, you know, a lot of monkey see, monkey do. But
who are you calling a monkey?
No, I'm the monkey. I see what's going on and I do the same thing. And CVS web was, my apologies to the authors out there, but oh my God, was it a mess. There were so many globals in there, and then there'd be a call to some function with side effects on those globals. rather than like, you know, returning them as actual return values. And so it was so hard to follow the logic and all the side effects and everything that was going on. And I just, at some point I just snapped. And it was just like, okay, I can port this 2200 line script to Python and then edit the thing in less time than it would take me to figure out this mess. And so I sat down one weekend. It took me about 2.5 days, and I ported that sucker over to Python. And then, you know, I launched that project, and that was, I called it ViewCVS. And it, with a lot of work from a guy named Mike Pilato at CollabNet and another guy named Russ Yanevsky, and you know, numerous other contributions, but those are the two primary guys. It grew support for Subversion. And so now it's got, you know, CVS and Subversion support. And at that point, we eventually said, all right, fine, let's just rename it ViewVC. And so it's hosted at ViewVC.org now. I'm not really contributing to it. I shouldn't say not really. I'm not contributing to it anymore. Mike is really kind of the lead on that. And he's done some really great work with it.
But that's great that you were able to take something that was the ugly, bad style of Perl that we were embarrassed that some people still did, and were able to turn it into a product that you could maintain. You know, I have to say that in defense of my fellow Perl hackers, they're going to be mad if I don't somehow bring that back in. It's not Perl versus Python on this. It's that there was a really bad Perl programmer or few that made it all global.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All the languages you can mess up terribly.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, I think, you know, with Perl, to be honest, I think you have to be really good to create maintainable Perl.
Mm-hmm. I'll agree.
If you're novice or intermediate, be careful. With Python, a novice can totally mess it up. But intermediate, it starts to get a little harder. And so I do find that's kind of the pattern, but it doesn't you know, begrudge Perl anything as a language itself. It's a lot more mature than some other new kids on the block that we won't mention.
Anything starting with an R, perhaps?
Oh, maybe.
Okay. We'll get them on. We'll let them rebut you there. That'll be cool.
We're trying to get Matt's on. I don't know if his English is good enough to be on, but I'd love to get him on. Maybe we can get a translator to work with him.
We'll find somebody in the U.S. to speak.
Yeah. I'd like to see Ruby in you know, another 3 years or so, once they get bindings to more underlying libraries and things. You know, that's one of the advantages that Python and Perl have had, is they've been around for so long. You know, you want a binding to the Berkeley DB library. Fine, it's been done. Right, you want a binding to, you know, the GTK toolkit. Done. But Ruby, not so much. Give it a little more time, and then it'll start to get really interesting.
Speaking of Python, I've got to ask this question. You got Microsoft to ship Python code in 1996?
Wait, what? Where? What Python code? What?
Yeah, I did. So in 91, I started a company with some other guys, and we started out doing pen-based software for the PenPoint operating system. We did a number of different things, but we eventually moved into electronic commerce in 93. And then in 96, Microsoft needed to really get their electronic commerce efforts going, and it wasn't working well in-house. And so they kind of popped their head up and looked around the landscape, and they saw us and another company called BroadVision. BroadVision was big and therefore expensive. We were 30-some people and not as expensive. And we'd been doing electronic commerce for several years. And so they bought us up, and our commerce system was written in Python. And we had this neat little attachment thing that would go from Apache to a long-running Python process, which then had, you know, maintained open connections to Oracle database. And so it was actually quite efficient. You could do some serious online commerce. Well, when we got to Microsoft, this was in June 96, we switched over the instead of Apache to the long-running process, it became IIS through named pipes to some back-end long-running NT services. But that NT service was really just a thin wrapper that had an embedded Python interpreter in it.
Ah! That's great.
So we didn't ship the .py files. It was all .pycs, but it was like October 96, Microsoft Merchant Server 1.0 was delivered, And if you installed that, you could go in and find a directory with that .pyc file sitting there.
Wow.
Wonderful.
If you did that today, it'd hit the headlines. I mean,
oh yeah, yeah. And then in December 96, they came out with Active Server Pages, and there you could embed COM objects right into their server pages. And so we got rid of our custom templating system and turned all of our things into COM objects, which were still implemented in Python, by the way. And those went into Site Server 2.0. And so Site Server 2.0 also has some Python in it. So, yeah, Microsoft for a little while did ship some Python.
Well, this is around the era where Microsoft was investing in Active State, which had Python looking. So, yeah, in that time frame. Yeah. Yeah. Nice. Cool.
Yeah, Active State owned Python for a while, didn't they?
No.
No.
Well, they collaborate a lot on Perl, no. But they produced the Microsoft version of both Perl and
that's
Python.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Python started at CWI in the Netherlands.
Right.
And then there's a company. It's hard to call it a company. Some weird government sort of research thingy. I don't know. Called CNRI back in Reston. And they brought Guido over and hired him and got him, you know, the whole Visa thing. And they owned a lot of the rights around Python for the longest time. And then the team moved to BOpen. And so BOpen ended up having some rights. And then finally, we created the Python Software Foundation. We got everybody to sign over their copyrights to the PSF. And so now it's all clean.
So it's all resolved. Oh, that's really good. Yeah, because it was a mess for a while.
Yeah, it was pretty bad.
Yeah.
Wow, cool.
Well, we're going to let you go and cough. I know you're not feeling so well, Greg.
Oh, and happy birthday, by the way.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Today's his birthday? It's
last weekend, yes.
Oh, that's great. Well, go cough on Chris DeBona.
Yeah, actually, Chris just came in. He's over there typing at his keyboard, pretending like I'm not actually talking to you guys.
The funny thing is, I think he always said, we got to get Greg Stein on. And we just never did. He was waiting until we had a giant audience before we brought
Actually, what it is he really hates me, but he pretends pretty well.
That works.
I love it. What's he saying? I hear him over there.
He's like, miss you guys.
Hi, Chris. Chris
DeBona. Hey, it's been really great talking to you. I mean, boy, it just when I look at all the things you had a hand in over the last 10 years, more than 10 years, it's quite remarkable.
Thanks.
And you're happy at Google? You're gonna stay there for a while, or are you? What else? What would you like to do? Is there anything left undone?
Well, one of the things that I've been finding is I haven't had as much time to do coding, open source coding, as I would like. So, you know, if it's not Google, sort of return to that man of leisure thing and work on open source coding again.
Yeah. What project would you work on? A new one or?
There's a bunch of stuff that I want to kind of wrap up, things that, you know, I'd started at one point or another, like that HTTP client library I was talking about, you know, get back into that and make that, you know, really work, and maybe get back into the Apache HTTP server. You know, I don't really know. I mean, it's not something I'm pondering right this second, but, you know, if you had to ask me, that would be that would be something I would do.
Awesome. Cool. Well, Greg, thank you for WebDev. Thank you for Google Code and for your stewardship at Apache and Python. And we really appreciate it.
Yeah, well, no problem. You're quite welcome. And thank you.
Yeah. Been a real boon to the open source community. Thank you, Greg.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. I just have to figure out how to hang up this thing. Oh, yeah. There we go. It's not open source. I wish it were to be. It'd probably be easier to use. Isn't that interesting? You seem to agree with him that the idea of commercial software is just an idea whose time has gone.
Well, I think for infrastructure, like I addressed, I think for infrastructure,
you need some proprietary stuff. I understand.
Yeah, because you know, there's always going to be the need for a specific client to specifically have code that applies really only to them and becomes their competitive advantage.
Right.
And I think that's going to remain closed source. And so I actually straddle the two. I have obviously a huge open source bent because that's, you know, it's really the thing that's paid my bills for the last 20 years. But I do that by taking the open source and layering on top of that some proprietary code so that my clients can get their competitive advantage. But in the meanwhile, I try to go back to them and say, now I've done 100 lines of code for you. Can I take 40 lines of this and put this back in the pot for the next guy to take?
Right. That's a nice way to do it, isn't it? Yeah.
At Marriott, you know, I get paid for the full 100 lines, but 40 lines of that now becomes open source. It's like the potluck gets to continue because of that. We start with the sourdough starter,
right,
and we get to keep bringing it forward and keep bringing it forward and create the next round of sourdough.
Well, and that's also in the nature of the GPL license. You know, that viral nature of it does encourage people to kind of, if not continue to do open source, at least give back.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It's just, and Greg is a perfect example of that, of somebody who's gone, you know, from one, I'm not going to say from one job to the next. It makes him sound like he's a vagabond. But
well, I know. If you look at his resume, it's darn impressive. But it's like almost, he can't keep a job.
Yeah, well, he's probably the same short attention span that I am. Yeah, I mean, I have this. Yeah. If you look at my list of clients I've had over the last 20 years, sure, it's sort of like that as well. But it's like, but he's been able to find the way to contribute and yet at the same time further the notion of open source. It's a wonderful marriage when you can get that to happen, when you can actually find your niche, do your thing, and make it something that some company can make money at so that they can pay you and you can pay, you know, your house bill and your car bill and things like that.
One thing that this discussion reminded me of is the interview Krista Bona and I did with Larry Augustin, who, of course, started CollabNet. But one of the things that Larry and VA Linux, we should mention, one of the things that Larry was talking about and his current passion is open source enterprise software. Mm-hmm. And he's really mentored a number of companies. And we're going to talk next time with a very interesting open source enterprise project.
Mm-hmm.
It's Sugar CRM.
CRM, yes, the director of Sugar CRM has agreed to talk to us. So that's really a big score there.
Yeah.
That'd be really fun.
Yeah, but very interesting. You know, it's his position that soon enterprise software would all be open source because the barrier entry is so low. You don't have to get a purchase order or approval. You just go out and you try it. People like it. There's a lot of great enterprise grade software out there now in the open source. And this is just the natural wave of the future. We'll talk about how a CRM program can be open source and succeed.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Yeah. That's next week on Floss Weekly. Thank you, Randall Schwartz. Thank you to Greg Stein. And thank you all for listening. We're really glad you do. We'd love to hear from you. Do you want to give out an email address, Randall, for people to contact you?
I've been getting lots and lots of requests for new software, but yes, I can always use a couple more. So that would be Merlyn, Merlyn, at Stonehenge.com. And if you can't remember that, just Google for Go-Go Puffs.
What?
Google for Go-Go Puffs. You type in Go-Go Puffs into Google, you will come right to my homepage. That's a long story, but it's there.
I think a story we better talk about next time. That sounds very interesting. Google for Go-Go Puffs. He's Google for Go-Go Puffs. Randall Schwartz, we'll talk to you next time on Floss Weekly.